The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept it, and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Sadhguru, because realizing it is what will make us free. We can talk about it all we want to, and it won't do a single thing, except perhaps entertain us intellectually. So today is the fourth day of this seven-day sesshin here in northern New Jersey in Lawrenceville at Turtleback Zendo in March 2019. And it looks balmy out, but it's actually only 32 degrees. Nonetheless, spring is coming. Spring is here. The light is bigger. The light is brighter. Hopes are rising. Energy is rising as well. When everything's dark in the winter, there's more of a sense of just going deep down, snuggling into a nice warm bed. But in springtime, all possibilities are suddenly available. And among those possibilities is a deepening practice. I'd like to share with you now from a very fascinating book called The Quantum Revelation by Paul Levy, a radical synthesis of science and spirituality. And now we will bump into the spirituality part. But there is a chapter called Quantum Buddha Nature, Chapter 9. And I'll share some from it. Quantum entities don't have, quote unquote, or possess, quote unquote, intrinsic properties. Quantum entities don't have or possess intrinsic quantities. As you heard in earlier Tay shows about this book and what it revealed, that the tiniest, supposedly the tiniest known components of matter, a photon, has a mind of its own. And that mind of its own is quite influenced by the minds of the experimenters who are trying to figure it out, trying to nail it down as something concrete. Quantum entities don't have or possess intrinsic properties. Jonathan Alday, author of Quantum Reality, Theory and Philosophy, writes, quote, "Our whole manner of speech rather naturally makes us think that there is some stuff or substance which properties can, in a sense, be glued. It encourages us to imagine taking a particle and removing its properties one by one until we're left with a featureless thing devoid of properties made from the essential material that had the properties in the first place. Now it seems experimental science has come along and shown that, at least at the quantum level, the objects we study have no substance to them, independent of their properties. When we remove the last property and the quantum entity dissolves into itself, there's nothing left. So no thing that has the properties. Quantum field is empty of substance, and yet this substanceless substance appears to be what everything that appears to be substantial is made of." The quantum field is empty of substance, and yet this substanceless substance appears to be what everything that appears to be substantial is made of. Centuries ago, Rinzai, the great master, Chinese master Linji, said, "There's a true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of your senses. In the eyes, it is called seeing. In the ears, it is called hearing. In the tongue it is called speaking. In the hands it is called gripping. And in the feet it is called carrying us. If you haven't seen it yet, see it now. See it now. And that actually is a koan in the Rinzai system of koans. There's a true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of our senses. It's not like there's us or a me and this true person of rank or no rank. A true person of no rank is that substanceless substance that is who we are. So, as we do our practice, we are extending the out-breath, reaching beyond words. And we don't even know what we're reaching for, because there can be no picture of what we're reaching for, because it has no substance. Or does it? That's for us to find out. We reach. When we find ourselves feeling self-consciously aware, we try to find something solid that is that self-conscious awareness, something solid that is the person having the self-conscious awareness. And we keep at it until at some point, suddenly our mind shifts and we understand this true person of no rank, this featureless feature, this substanceless substance, this form as emptiness, this emptiness as form, that is who we really are. And then, when we realize that deeply enough, it also dawns on us that there's nothing to be defended. There's nobody that is embarrassed, can be embarrassed. That being embarrassed is a figment of our imagination, a cultural assumption. It's a great leap from feeling whatever we're feeling to seeing that there's nobody really owning that feeling. That feeling is a conjuring up of the mind. When we do realize it, the sense of freedom is phenomenal. The sense of freedom is phenomenal. We usually don't go very deep into it when we begin to realize it, and then we find ourselves going back out of it. Many, many years ago, I had been sitting on my own for about a year and a half. It's actually This incident is what took me to the Rochester Zen Center, because I had no clues as to what on earth had happened. But in those days, I was living in Turkey, and I had basically been driven to my knees from circumstances. I had lost everything. But fortunately, some months before that, I had had another experience in which I realized that there was going to be no end of wanting things, wanting objects, wanting things to be certain ways, wanting things not to be certain ways, exactly as the Buddha described the First Noble Truth. And I realized quite definitely that unless I got off that train, there would be continuing periods of pleasure for how long? Maybe a few hours, a few days, possibly a few weeks. And then there would be that wanting again, or the disappointment. And I also realized at the same time that there was nothing outside that could possibly offer lasting fulfillment, lasting peace. That the only place that that could be found was inside. And so when I arrived in Turkey some months later and was at a welcoming party for diplomats at the ambassador's house in Ankara, I encountered another guest who was just recently arrived from the United States, who happened to mention that he did meditation. At the time, this was back in the early 1970s, TM was quite popular, at least in the DC area where I was living and working at the time. And he mentioned that he could do TM. And so I said, great, teach me how to do TM. I'd wanted to do that. I hadn't had the time because I had my own business at the time and had to close it up in order to get to Turkey. And he said, no, I can't do that. You'll have to go to New York and get a mantra. And, on a foreign service officer's salary, one did not fly here and there across oceans. It's pretty basic back then. So then he said, well, I can teach you how to do Zazen. And my response was, no thanks, I wasn't interested. TM sounded quick and easy. I wasn't really interested in doing Zazen. That seemed featureless and uninspiring. Well, 3 months later, I was ready to do it. Because in the intervening months, I'd lost everything that meant anything to me. And I was in deep pain. To say deep pain really doesn't express it adequately. I was in agony. I was in such agony that I didn't want to live anymore. And then, to add insult to injury, I realized that I did not have the courage to kill myself. Which, of course, I'm quite grateful for now. And so the person that knew how to do Zazen happened to have a copy of a little thin book, the second book that Kapler Roshi had written. It was called The Wheel of Death. And I thought, well, if I can't do it, at least I can read about it. And I devoured the book in one sitting. Of course, it wasn't very long to devour it. Just took a fairly short time to read it at home. It had four chapters, death, dying, karma, and rebirth. And as I read through the book, there was the story of Socrates dying, in which all his students were wailing around him as they were around the Buddha. Not to equate them, but still, the pain of loss was there. And he said, why? Why are you wailing? It could be that death could be one of the most incredible things ever experienced. Why do you think it's so terrible? So I thought, And then there were the stories of various different Buddhist monks, masters really, who died simply, without regret, without anxiety, as if, as the Dalai Lama speaks of it, they were simply taking off one set of clothes. So I thought, what do they know that I don't know? And that's when I sat down and crossed my legs for the first time. I realized that was the only avenue through which I could become free of the agony. And it was not easy. It wasn't easy at all. For years it wasn't easy. I had to, as one person wrote in a writing about the session in which they came to awakening, they said they had to virtually nail themselves to the mat. I had to nail myself to the mat if I could get close enough to do that. But there was such resistance even to getting to the mat. It's kind of hard to nail myself to it. At any rate, I continued trying. And in those days, I would leave Turkey for a couple of months every year. Although I actually was working in Turkey. I worked for the Earthquake Research Institute at Boğaziçi University as a bilingual secretary. And I also worked very briefly for 3M, that's Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, who the company had moved their regional headquarters to Istanbul, where I was living by then. And so I worked there for a very short time as a bilingual secretary. And then one Saturday morning, my boss appeared at 7 o'clock in the morning at my apartment door and said, "Don't come to work on Monday." The previous incumbent of the position, who had been a Cypriot Turk, had been called in for questioning by the police. And being Cypriot, they have this curious situation where even though they're Turkish, they have to get a passport to go to enter Turkey. And the authorities had confiscated his passport. So my boss, who actually was Lebanese, but had a British wife, decided it was optimal to get out of the country while they still had their passports, and so he left. I didn't go to work, and I don't know what happened, but that was the end of my brief tenure with 3M. So I would go back to the States once a year. I did this for several years. Borrow a car from my parents. My father had retired, and they still had two cars, but they didn't need two cars anymore. I'd borrow a car and go to the Washington, D.C. area where I had had my business. And I was able to pick up with one of my clients any amount of work I wanted to. And so I would work for 16-hour days and stay in a residential hotel, which there are many of in the D.C. area, since it's a very transitory area. And I would sit zazen on my lunch hour when everybody else was out. And one evening I was having nothing else to do, so I went to a local bookstore. They had a very small little revolving rack of books, upon which there were maybe 6 or 7 Buddhist books. That was all that were published in those days. And I picked one up at random and started sort of flipping through it. And something jiggled in my mind. And I flipped some more and something jiggled again. So I bought the book, took it back to where I was staying, sat down and started reading a random page. The page happened to be a story that is attributed to Hakuin, but actually did not happen to Hakuin. It happened to his grandfather in Zen, Shido Unan. In the 1600s, Shido Unan, whose name, by the way, literally means "the great way is not difficult," that's his Buddhist name, was living in a little village in Japan, being Japanese. He was the priest in a little temple. And one day, a young girl got pregnant in the village, and she was not married. And her parents tried to get the name of the father of the child out of her, and she refused and refused and refused. Finally, she said, "Is that priest?" So when this baby was born, the grandparents marched it over to the temple and shoved it into Sheeta Wanand's hands and said, here, this is your doing, you take care of it. It's very difficult for us to comprehend the impact of that because our culture is so different. But in 17th century Japan, monks were celibate. Priests were celibate. It wasn't until the Meiji Restoration that they were ordered to exist as ordinary citizens of the country, therefore eligible for the draft and paying taxes and all the rest of it. But prior to that, they had a relatively more revered position, and they didn't marry. They didn't get involved with women, most of the time at least. And and he was innocent. In Japan, at any point, even now, but especially then, for something like that to happen was not only a grave embarrassment to the family, it was also a grave embarrassment to the whole village. And as I said, we really can't comprehend the depth of society's negativity around it. But they presented him with the baby, and he received the baby. And let's stop and think a minute. What our reaction would be if we were finding ourselves in exactly the same position. How would we feel? How would we react? Would we say, couldn't possibly be. I'm not that kind of a person. No way. She's lying. How would we have reacted? Well, I can tell you how Sheeta Wanand reacted. He didn't react. He responded. He clearly could see the pain in the family. He clearly responded to the pain in the family. He felt absolutely no need to defend himself. He had realized there's nobody to defend. And so what he did was to respond in this way, and it's really impossible to accurately translate it from the Japanese, but it was something like, oh, it looks like this, doesn't it? And he received the baby and took care of it for a year. Letters from the time say that he carried it around on his back like an old grandmother. The village scorned him. It was very difficult for him to find food to eat, much less take care of an infant. And of course, back then, they didn't have the usual cool things we have now, like paper diapers and all that stuff. But he did so lovingly for all year, and then the girl confessed who the father really was. And now the grandparents are twice as embarrassed because they've besmirched this good man's name, unnecessarily so. So they go back to the temple with their heads hung low, and they ask for the baby back. And how would we have reacted in those circumstances? Would we have said, how could you have not figured out it wouldn't have been me? Look what you've done to my life. I had a hell of a time even just surviving this year. But he didn't. Again, he said the same thing. So ka. Ka means question mark. So is something like, it's a very, very, very humble way of responding. Literally, it means, is that so? Or so it is. But again, it's a very humble response, something like, oh, it does seem like this, doesn't it? And the baby was given back. But as I read that, my mind plunged into Shiro Gonan's mind state. It was as if I was Shiro Gonan. And the sense of utter liberation was phenomenal. A sense of utter freedom, nobody needing to defend anything. Totally in harmony with the universe. I came to, I have no idea how long later, with tears of joy streaming down my face. That incident kept me practicing. I'm not going to say it was easy after that, but it was easier. And that's when I called up the Rochester Zen Center and said, something's happened. I have no clues as to what on earth happened to me. Can I talk to Kapla Roshi about it? And not long after that, I commuted from Turkey for my first sesshin, a 4-day. Some of you already know that when I returned to Turkey after that 4-day sesshin, which I only ever hoped to survive the schedule. I didn't dream of having any kind of opening. I just was hoping to survive the schedule of the Rochester Zen Center's sesshin. Got back to Turkey, I could not bring myself to walk into the room where my mat and cushion were for 3 solid weeks. Anything but that. Anything but that. But a few months later, I went back to Rochester. This time I moved permanently back to the United States to go to a 7-day sesshin and hope that somehow I'd be able to stay at the Rochester Zen Center. In those days, they had what they called training programs where they would host several people, probably 10 or 12 of us at a whack. You had to pay money to do that. And you'd follow the schedule of the center and live as if you were a monk there. And I just kept doing that until I had no more money. And by that time, it was August of the next year, and Kapla Roshi and Ruth Sandberg interviewed me and decided that I could stay at the center. I did that because I could see that I didn't have what was necessary in the way of discipline, self-discipline, to sit on my own on a regular basis. And that was because there was so much pain in my history that every time I would sit down across my legs, I would usually burst into tears because it was so painful. Not the sitting per se, but the memories that would come up. So this true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of our senses, this true person of no rank, this photon, if you want to call it, this emptiness, stop for a second and try to find right now any palpable sense of who you are, anything you can grab hold of. Can you find anything? Mostly we would just point to our body and say, well, that's me. But is it? Where'd you come from? Before you were born. What's going to happen to you when you die? Is that body all there is? And having seen a dead body, you know it can't move, you know it can't talk, you know it can't breathe or do the kinds of things that people do when they're alive. Where did the essence that made that body work go when the body died? Some more from the quantum revelation. What we call reality is simply a theory, a mental map, an internalized mental model, which at bottom is simply a way of looking at the world. It is a perspective rather than a form of absolutely true knowledge of how the world, quote, really, close quote, is. The word theory is derived from the Greek theoria, which has to do with contemplation, speculation, and sight. A theory is simply the way we are seeing and trying to apprehend the world at any given moment. It's important not to conflate reality with our theories, not to confuse the map with the territory. Our best models and theories are no more than aids to our imagination. By no means are they complete reflections of the nature of reality. Our theories not only fit what we know about the world, but at the same time, they point to what we don't know and ideally are able to reveal it to us. They can thus become supports for the ongoing process of continually refining our intuition. Where do we come from? Keep reaching. And of course, you already know it has to be done beyond words. Deep down within, keep testing what comes forth for you. Can you grab hold of anything that says it's me? I leave you with that. The more deeply you can plumb that question, who am I? The more free you will become. And the only freedom there really is. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.